A common understanding of baptism is that it's a membership ritual. The child or candidate is initiated with water and words into the church club. The candidate or the candidate's parents, sponsors, make statements assenting to the club's beliefs. To be baptized in this understanding is to choose to belong. Those churches that practice believers' baptism express this coming a member understanding most clearly. However, many churches that practice infant baptism have a similar understanding, with commitment being made by proxy. The parents and sponsors pledge allegiance to the club on the infant's behalf, until that child is of an age to make that commitment themselves. The baptismal theology of the 16th century Reformation, though, has quite a different understanding. It's all about God choosing us, rather than us presumptuously thinking that we are choosing God. The Reformers, Calvin and Luther, said that the baptism that creates belonging is the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. In other words, the word baptism is used as a metaphor for the saving work of Jesus. When the Anglican Prayer Book refers to baptism as the sacrament by which we are made children of God, it's not referring to the water and words around the font, but to the saving work of Jesus. This is the basis of that well-known quote from Karl Barth, when Barth asked, "When did you become a Christian?" And Barth responds, 33 AD. So God in Jesus, through God in Jesus, the whole world is loved, embraced, accepted, and said to belong. God and Jesus haven't formed a church club. Instead, they've taken down the walls of the religion club and said, everyone's welcome. Those of faith or no faith, those deemed acceptable and those deemed unacceptable. There is neither male nor female, slave nor free, clean nor unclean, saved nor unsaved. All humanity is one and is loved. Of course, the Reformers wouldn't agree with my last sentence. They, like many Christians, are still imprisoned in that delineation between saved and unsaved, still promoting the idea that they know what God thinks, who are God's favorites, who's got reserved seating, and who shouldn't be let in. In other words, they still have a club mentality. And I think in doing so, belittle and shrink God. The Reformers would also not agree when I say that the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus revealed the constant nature of God, rather than struck a new supernatural cosmic deal. The essence of God, the power of mutual relation, was always one that loved, embraced, redeemed, and said that everyone belonged. And that's why my favorite baptism story, as read by Billy this morning, is from the Islamic Sufi tradition. The reprehensible youth, the neighbor that none of us want, the unrepentant sinner, is, according to that divine voice in the story, God's friend. And when God calls him friend, the youth has not changed his proud and selfish ways. It's not like the young man and the prodigal son who comes to his senses while in the pig pen. This youth hasn't said sorry to anyone. He's just really happy going on being a pain in the neck. Rather, the initiative is solely with God. God, who's given that literal voice, states that this boy, like every boy and girl, like every adult and child, is God's friend. God's always accepted and loved, extending grace even when no grace is warranted. And it is that love and grace that inspires this youth to go on and serve those entrapped in poverty. So when a child is baptized, we, the church, are acknowledging the grace and acceptance of God extended to all. We're not saying that this child, due to their good looks or intelligence or parents' good looks or intelligence, is special in God's sight. Rather, we're proclaiming that everyone, every child, is special in God's sight. Baptism isn't an invitation to join a club. It's a declaration that in God, all the walls and policies and rules of religious clubs fundamentally don't matter and don't count. In Luke 13, this reading today, Jesus meets a woman who is badly crippled, and he wants to and does heal her. The problem is, it's the Sabbath day, the one day of the week when the club rules say, honor God by doing nothing, a kind of church bureaucracy response to anything contentious. Jesus argues with the synagogue leader, but Jesus' argument is actually pretty weak. Animals need water on the Sabbath because it's necessary for survival. The woman and Jesus could have waited a day longer. After all, she'd been bent crippled for 18 years. As we read the Gospels, we often realize how Jesus did things deliberately on the Sabbath, did something rather than nothing on that one day of the week, whether it was plucking corn to eat, healing sick people, or exercising whatever demons are. I think he did it deliberately. I think it was a deliberate part of his spiritual, political strategy of challenging the dominant religious club of his day. And his soundbite was quite simple. The Sabbath was made for people, not people for the Sabbath. The rules were made for people, not people for the rules. In other words, people's needs always trump club rules. Yet Jesus had more to say than that. He wanted to radically change the rules. He wanted to open the doors of the club so wide that it would cease to be a club. It would become unhinged. Religion would change beyond recognition. As I mentioned last week, Jesus' primary method of political protest was eating and drinking with undesirables. The meal table exemplified in miniature the power structure of society, and I would suggest it often still does. And Jesus' meal table envisioned then his dream of what society might be. His critics were horrified, for example, at the thought of women, especially unmarried women, being at his dining table, and thus accused him of eating with prostitutes. Prostitutes is a standard denigrating label for any woman outside of male control. Those labeled prostitutes were, in the opinion of his critics, people with whom open and free association should be avoided, lest one be contaminated. Jesus' open policy and vision was good news for those beyond the walls of religion. Illness and poverty, for example, were seen as signs of sinfulness and also dangerous contaminants. Yet Jesus didn't see it that way. He envisioned God's realm as a big banquet table where the last and little ones in society, the ill and the poor, would be welcomed in, polluting everyone, and be served first. It was a very topsy-turvy vision, and also highly political outside of the religion club. For first century Palestinian society was structured in strict hierarchical lines. You know, patriarch in charge, elder son, next son, next son, first wife, the concubine, slaves, dogs. And society, religion emulated that hierarchy and supported it. Well, Jesus envisioned this new family beyond patriarchy, where everyone, male and female, child or slave, were welcome, were equal siblings in God, where mutual affection, equality in decision-making, fidelity to one another were worked out in a context of equality. The Jesus movement sought to redefine family just as it sought to redefine both power and God. How people imagine God, according to Bill Loder, is directly related to how they imagine a decent person to be. For many generations, the most highly valued person was the one with the greatest power and wealth and sometimes knowledge. So people inevitably imagine God as being like this. And the way to live was to try to get on with people of influence. The same applied to God. Keep the commandments. Commandments are not to be questioned. They have absolute authority because they come from absolute authority. Yet Jesus had a totally different way of imagining God. For him, God was not modeled on an aloof king or a powerful father, but on a mother looking for a lost coin, and a dad who cast aside his dignity and ran to embrace the son who had deeply hurt him. The facade of dignity and power was dropped in favor of affection and love. It was a deeply challenging redefinition of God, God's power, and how human power should be exercised. So should a baby be baptized, welcomed, and celebrated in church? Of course, you might say. But what if its parents or parent are despicable scumbags, and the child is likely to grow up the same? Shouldn't the church uphold values of right behavior and therefore discourage and even punish wrong behavior? Doesn't God have standards, and shouldn't we? These questions, though valid, don't reflect the vision of Jesus. Instead, they reflect our need to form clubs and set rules. Baptism follows only one rule, the rule of grace. In the name of grace, Jesus deconstructed the walls of religion clubs and let all the bent and battered riffraff in. To paraphrase Edwin Markham, religion drew a circle that shut many out, heretics, rebels, failures, no doubt. But love and Jesus had the wit to win. They drew a bigger circle that took everyone in.